At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The terrorist money trail has taken multiple shapes in the near decade since 9/11. Authorities worldwide tried to cast a net around every possible source of financing for operations. With the death of Osama bin Laden, the shape of that money trail may shift again. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs at novonordisk-us.com. And by MassMutual, offering retirement and 401k plans to businesses for more than 60 years. MassMutual.com/retirestrong.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the third day of May. Today, the White House clarified some details of Sunday's raid on the bin Laden compound in Pakistan. It said the terrorist mastermind was not armed but did resist before he was shot and killed. It also said that the U.S. Navy SEAL team that conducted the raid seized computer hard drives that could help in tracking terror cells and the money used to operate them. On yesterday's broadcast, we examined what bin Laden's death means for future financing of terrorism. We're going to look now at how counterterrorism officials follow that money trail. Matthew Levitt is at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
In the years following 9/11, most of the focus on terror financing was on money laundering operations, charities, freezing assets of suspected donors. How has that financing changed, if it has?
Well, it's developed. People tend to lose sight of the fact there are two sides to the countering terror financing coin. One of them focuses on stemming the flow of funds. The other half of it, and sometimes the much more powerful half of it, is not stemming the flow of funds, but allowing those flows to continue once we've identified them so that we can follow them for financial intelligence purposes.
How centralized is terror funding at this point? We heard on the program yesterday that, yes, bin Laden had a fundraising machine of sorts, but that there are so many splinter groups now that it's not that centralized.
I think that al-Qaeda's financing has become much more decentralized. Some of the franchises, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and the Islamic Maghreb, finance on their own in North Africa, largely through kidnapping.
How much of this financing goes through the world banking system at this point, or does it move around in other ways?
Terrorists writ large, not just al-Qaeda, have diversified. They don't put their eggs in any one basket anymore. Ever since it was exposed that the U.S. government had the ability to look into international transfers to identify terror financing, you have to assume that our adversaries have also branched out into hawalas or other types of remittances, cash couriers. But I think they can never fully leave the formal financial system because it's too reliable, too fast, and they can hide in plain sight, as bin Laden did for several years in this McMansion.
Is it possible that bin Laden could be as effective or more effective in death as in life raising money for al-Qaeda?
I think he could be. You could go around with a bin Laden clip right now to people who are angry about his death, probably rile them up and get them to donate some money. But it's also the case that because of this action, those people who are affiliated with al-Qaeda or sympathetic to it have to be wondering, have we penetrated their email, their phones? Now it's clear that we've penetrated some courier networks. If I were a fundraiser, I'd be concerned that someone offering to donate money might be a source for authorities and vice versa, that if someone came to me with a pitch, can you donate? I might be concerned that they, too, were some type of undercover.
I was reading today that 9/11 cost an estimated $500,000, while the 2005 London attacks only cost about $2,000. How do we go after terror financing if these types of events can be carried out for so little money?
It's true that any given attack only costs a little bit of money nowadays. But it's not true that terrorism is cheap. If you're a homegrown violent extremist, you can carry out that particular attack relatively inexpensively. But if you are trying to establish an organization, you're going to have larger costs. For example, we found that Al-Qaeda in Iraq was bearing significant expenses, taking care of the families of its operatives, seeing to their day jobs, etc. Even if it only costs a little bit of money, if we can follow that money, if we can tag it, watch it, and follow it, that can identify people who are everywhere from the donors in the bottom to the operatives at the top.
Matthew Levitt is director of the Stein Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On Wall Street, an essentially flat day with the Dow ending down less than a point. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Being a North African dictator is a little less profitable these days. Swiss banks say they've frozen about $1 billion worth of assets, reportedly belonging to Messrs. Gaddafi of Libya, Mubarak of Egypt, and Ben Ali of Tunisia. Now that the money is frozen, anyone wanting to thaw it out, say Mubarak's successors in Egypt, faces an uphill battle. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
When Colonel Gaddafi fell out with Switzerland a few years ago, he vowed to pull all his cash out of the country. But he seems to have left some spare change behind. Today, the Swiss government said it has frozen $415 million belonging to the Libyan despot, and a similar sum linked to the toppled Egyptian dictator. The announcement is designed to burnish Switzerland's new image as a squeaky clean financial centre. But, says Haig Simonian of the Financial Times in Zurich, there's still one awkward little question. Why were these dictators allowed to stash their cash in Switzerland?
The Swiss authorities, despite all their efforts to try and make sure that they only receive clean money, nothing controversial, have still not managed to screen the funds coming their way adequately.
And there's another issue. The frozen assets will not be returned immediately to the countries from which they were looted. It could take anywhere from 3 to 10 years before that happens. Officially, the delay is due to Swiss legal process. But money laundering expert Jeffrey Robinson is sceptical.
The governments are not in any hurry to return this money. Why should they? As long as they can hold on to it, they can earn money off the back of it.
And he says it'll be especially interesting to see how long it takes to repatriate the $34 billion of Libyan assets frozen by the United States. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
The Arabian Spring began with a winter of frustration.
Commentator Raj Patel.
In North Africa, the urban poor couldn't afford the rising prices of staples like bread and milk. Starting in Algeria, they took to the streets, and at least in Tunisia, it worked. One of the last things that former President Ben Ali did was to slash the price of bread, milk, and sugar. It didn't save Ben Ali's presidency, but cheap food has been the way that governments around the world have kept the lid on urban discontent for more than 2,000 years. We do it in the US too. Cheap food has been a policy choice for decades, bought with a great chain of subsidy for big agriculture and big food. That's why we spend far less on food at the checkout than pretty much any other industrial country. The Japanese, for example, spend more than twice as much of their household income to eat than we do. Of course, there are worries that our dollar burgers aren't as good for you as European or Asian cheap eats. Recently, First Lady Michelle Obama did her bit to address that by backing Walmart's drive to sell cheap organic produce to the poor. The trouble with this is that cheap food addresses the symptom of hunger rather than its cause. It doesn't matter how cheap food is. If people are unemployed or don't have the money to buy it, they still go hungry. That's why a record 50 million Americans are food insecure today. The way to fight hunger in America isn't to give money to big ag and big food, nor does the answer lie in trimming environmental or labor standards to keep prices low. It's to create jobs with living wages so that instead of being cheap, food becomes affordable to everyone. America is no stranger to the food protest. Food rebellions predate the American Revolution. And food riots led by women resulted in women's right to vote less than a century ago, right here in the United States. In an era of rising prices and persistent unemployment, we can expect not only more food rebellions around the world, but perhaps for them to happen much closer to home.
Raj Patel is the author of The Value of Nothing. Got a comment? Send them to marketplace.org and click on the contact link. You can also tweet us and post on our Facebook page. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is postponing the day of reckoning for the nation's debt ceiling. Thanks to an unanticipated boost in tax revenues, it'll be August instead of mid-May. Yesterday, Geithner wrote to Congress begging members to raise the ceiling as fast as possible so the government can continue to pay its bills on time. Politicians are using the debt limit as a football in the larger fight over fiscal policy. But why do we have a debt ceiling in the first place? Marketplace's David Gura has some answers from Washington.
Let's start with a definition.
The debt limit is the maximum amount of debt that Congress allows the federal government to take on.
Bill Gale is an economist at the Brookings Institution. In the U.S., Congress has the power of the purse. When the government isn't collecting enough revenue, it has to borrow to cover the programs Congress authorizes. But Congress sets a limit on how much debt the government can rack up. Donald Ritchie, the U.S. Senate historian, tells me Congress has controlled spending from the very beginning.
Congress approved things in advance when they were facing a problem, when they'd gone into war, when there was an economic crisis, when they needed to raise money. They turned to Congress, and Congress appropriated a loan or some sort of a bond drive or something to raise the funds for that particular occasion.
But that changed in 1917. World War I was expensive, and no one knew how long it would last. So Congress said, look, we'll give the government more latitude to borrow money as it goes along, but within reason.
If you have to go beyond that, we can pass a short-term increase, but we'll just assume that you'll spend up to that amount.
At first, there were small increases, but over the years, the government had to borrow big bucks for World War II and Vietnam, Iraq and Afghanistan. Since 1962, Congress has raised the debt ceiling 74 times. Now it hovers around $14 trillion. Bill Gale explains how he got to where we are.
Congress has authorized the government to spend money
for highways, for Medicare, for the wars we're fighting.
They've authorized them to cut taxes.
The so-called Bush-era tax cuts, which President Obama extended a few months ago.
But Congress has not authorized the government to borrow the money to make up the difference.
I asked Bill Gale if Congress raising the debt ceiling is like my bank agreeing to boost my credit limit.
It's not like the credit card raising your credit limit. It's like you authorizing yourself to pay the credit card debt that you put on the bill.
The government has to pay its bills, but a number of politicians say it would be irresponsible to raise the debt ceiling. Gale says they're either ignorant or deceiving the American public.
Not raising the debt limit right now wouldn't reduce the path of future spending. It wouldn't increase future tax revenues. Those are separate decisions that still have to be made.
According to Gale, this whole debate about the debt ceiling is about one thing: politics.
The party that controls the White House is always in favor of increasing the debt limit because they have the job of actually paying the bills that Congress authorizes the government to spend. The opposition party always uses it to score political points.
And Gale says this time is no different. He expects Congress will vote to raise the ceiling again, but in the meantime, it's become a vehicle, some say inappropriately, to debate the role of government itself. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Coming up, the Freakonomics of Corporate Succession.
My dad talks about the ovarian lottery, this idea that you're born into these circumstances that you can't control when you're on the other side of being born.
Why it might be better to go outside the family. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow stood still today, ending right where it started at 12,807. The Nasdaq peeled off 22 points, 0.75% to end at 2841. And the S&P 500 fell 4 points, 0.33% to finish at 1356. General Motors motored up 2.5% today. GM reported overall sales rose 26% in April. Fuel-efficient compact cars and crossovers were in demand. Ford gained 16% over a year ago and reported the same trend. That said, investors still dented the company's stock by nearly 0.5%. Bank of America deposited 2%. J.P. Morgan banked more than 1.5%. And MasterCard pocketed 2.5% on higher first-quarter profits. The 10-year T-note gained, pushing the yield down to 3.25%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. Entrepreneurship reporting is supported by Deluxe Corp, a marketing resource to 4 million small businesses with logo and website design, search engine marketing, and more at deluxe.com/marketing. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up tomorrow. The Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on budget enforcement mechanisms. The House Homeland Security Committee discusses securing our nation's mass transit systems against a terrorist attack. FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate testifies. And later in the day, he'll be at the National Press Club to talk about planning for catastrophic disasters and FEMA's efforts to use social media to better engage the public. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Officials in Missouri made a Sophie's choice last night. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers intentionally blew up a key agricultural levee to keep floodwaters from inundating the town of Cairo, Illinois. But in the process, some farmers in Missouri lost everything, their crops, their homes, and quite possibly the soil in which to replant once the crisis is over. Adam Allington reports from St. Louis Public Radio.
Ed Marshall farms about 8,000 acres in Mississippi County in southeast Missouri. At this time of the year, he normally looks out on miles of corn and wheat, but right now...
It's water as far as I can see, you know, and our ground is as flat as a table, so I can see for 7-8 miles. And there's nothing but water.
The decision by the Army Corps to blow up the levee has helped waters recede slightly from Cairo, a town of about 2,000 people, but it comes at the expense of about $300 million worth of corn and wheat that was already in the ground in Missouri. Still, the flooding is not expected to have much of an effect on the U.S. grain market. Scott Gerlt is a crop analyst with the University of Missouri.
Farmers have signaled their intention this year to plant 92 million acres of corn, about 77 million acres of soybeans. So we're just looking at a small percent of that.
Even with crop insurance, Gerlt says farmers typically do not recover the entire value of lost crops. But Illinois Senator Dick Durbin says the federal government will not ignore stricken farmers in Missouri.
We don't let people down. You know, when we kind of stand together as a family, we want to save this town and the people who live here. And if the folks on the other side of the river are hurt in any way because of this flooding, we're going to stand by them, and we should.
But even with federal assistance, farmer Ed Marshall worries the flooding could strip away much of his valuable topsoil.
It's sad. It really is. You know, you spend your whole life, you know, building this ground up and trying to leave it in better shape than the way it was given to you.
The Corps of Engineers set off a second planned explosion at about noon today. This time, however, the 5,000-foot breach was put there to help floodwater flow back into the Mississippi River. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We are still a nation of couch potatoes. That bulletin comes to us today from the Nielsen Ratings Service, which found nearly 97% of U.S. households own a TV. Sounds like a lot, and it is, but the report also found that TV ownership is actually down about 2 points, and that hasn't happened for the last 20 years. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story from New York.
Television is the great American pastime. Almost every single U.S. household has one. But the numbers are slipping, and part of it is the economy.
We are coming out of a recession, and that the recession actually causes people to give up their television sets.
Nielsen's Pat McDonough says television ownership dropped in the early 90s during that downturn. But when the economy recovered, Americans went out and snapped up TV sets. But this time could be different, says McDonough, because a lot of people who don't have TVs now are young, wealthy, and well-educated.
We believe they may be using their internet connection as a substitute for a television subscription.
Like 25-year-old West Hollywood resident Andrew Barrow.
Then I realized I was paying $70 a month for nothing. I really never used cable.
Barrow now only watches TV on his computer, and his friends are also switching off their TVs.
It's more of a luxury item at this point, and almost like an unnecessary luxury.
About 140 million people watch TV on their computers, and they tend to be the younger viewers advertisers want to target, says Brad Adgate with Horizon Media.
It's not really that much different from young people cutting off their landlines and just being cell phone only homes. The ad dollars are going to follow the eyeballs.
TV still gets most of those eyeballs and ad dollars, but Adgate says that's clearly going to change. He predicts a lot of people who killed their TVs during the recession won't go back. In New York, with 1,300 cable channels, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It's Freakonomics time. Every 2 weeks, we're talking with Stephen Dubner, co-author of the books and the blog about the hidden side of everything. Hello there, Stephen.
Hey, Tess. I was wondering, have you got your resume sent off to Omaha yet?
Oh, I did that long ago, my friend.
Yeah, because, you know, Warren Buffett needs to have somebody run Berkshire Hathaway when he's done. And I'm guessing they'd be dying to have you in there.
I think they would. And, you know, now that David Sokol is out, naturally, I would be next in line.
Naturally. Now, if for some reason Buffett doesn't pick you to run Berkshire, you know, he should have his head examined. But he could just do what a lot of CEOs do, which is pick one of his kids, right? But Buffett's actually taken a very well-known stance against nepotism. Listen to his son, Peter Buffett.
You know, my dad talks about the ovarian lottery.
So Peter Buffett won that lottery, but he says his dad never pressured him or his siblings to go into the family business, so Peter Buffett got to focus on his music, he's a composer, and on philanthropy, and as he tells it, that is probably a good thing.
The odds of having a son or daughter that are as passionate and excited and driven as the founder of a business was, or even the person that took it over, I think are incredibly small.
But, you know, Stephen, I think a lot of business founders don't think that way. The Buffetts are kind of a unique example. I mean, Warren Buffett has really made a point to say he is not going to give his kids his $47 billion fortune or the keys to the corner office.
You're right. And you're also right in that elsewhere, in most places, the Church of Scientology, as I like to call it, which is handing off the family firm to the family scion, it's booming. You know, roughly one-third of Fortune 500 companies are family control. But the important thing I wanted to know is this: is handing down a business good for business? So I asked Antoinette Shore, a finance professor at MIT, who studied family firm succession.
We actually see drops in performance of these firms
after they are transitioning from a founder to the heir or the heirs, we see drops between 10 and 20% of profitability.
Right, but I mean, you don't go into business to make a profit, right? No, I'm just kidding. Of course you do. But, you know, there have to be other
reasons. What
country
are you from? Yeah.
You know, if I spend my whole life building a business, I might actually want my son or daughter to take it over. It's part of the legacy.
Absolutely. There's a lot of reasons why people do pass firms on to the family, but there are also some not so obvious reasons. I talked to Vikas Mehrotra, who's a finance professor at the University of Alberta.
Trust is in short supply typically in countries where families are dominant.
Did you catch that, Tess? In countries where family firms are dominant, trust is in short supply. Now, what that means is trust is kind of shorthand here for having strong institutions, for having transparent markets. When you don't have all that, you don't have as many options for passing the company along, and you're more likely to protect your firm by simply handing it off to Junior.
Whether Junior wants it or not.
Exactly, right, yeah.
But of course, hopefully, that is we don't see that as a problem here in the U.S. You know, there are a lot of options here.
Which is why, believe it or not, the U.S., for all the family firms we see around us, the U.S. actually has one of the lowest rates of Scientology in the world. And there's also the fact that we in the U.S. helped pioneer a management model. Here's Richard Silla, who's a financial historian at NYU.
The first business schools were founded in the United States. I think the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania was founded in 1883.
So because we've got all these folks who have a pedigree, they've actually got an education, you don't necessarily have to be related to the founder to take over as CEO.
That's what we believe in. And slowly, it seems, the rest of the world is starting to believe in that as well. In fact, Tess, I'm wondering, you have any interest in relocating perhaps to India?
No.
Well,
okay, I'll play along. Yes, sure.
If you don't want to go, I'm not going to force you. But I'm just saying there may be a nice little job opening there for someone like you if Buffett doesn't hire you and bring you to Omaha. Ratan Tata, who runs the Tata Group, this gigantic conglomerate, which is a family firm, he's looking for a CEO to succeed himself, and he's thinking about bringing in an outsider. So you might want to brush up that resume and get it off to Mumbai.
All right. Well, I like their cute little cars, so I'll think about it. Stephen Dubner, our Freakonomics correspondent, and there, of course, is more of his work at freakonomicsradio.com. Thanks. It's been fun.
Thanks for having me, Tess.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the Internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Manta.com, providing an online destination for small businesses to be found and to find new customers. More online at Manta.com. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at Putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, Pac-10 college football fans, rejoice. The New York Times reported today that the conference struck a goldmine television deal with Fox and ESPN. Not only is the Pac-10 creating its own cable network next year, but it's retaining full ownership instead of sharing like other conferences do. Fox and ESPN will pay some $3 billion over 12 years to air the games. The previous deal was a quarter of that. Thank you, Oregon Ducks. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow budged not a bit. The NASDAQ peeled off 22 points, 0.75%, and the S&P 500 fell 4 points, 0.33%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rada Bead. And that is where you can turn for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, hoping organics will make up the majority of the world food supply in the near future? Not so fast.
We just need too many nutrients. And one of the problems with organic is that their concentration of the nutrients, the organic sources, are very low.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.